So I find your analysis interesting. I think you made a couple of very important points. And one of them is the fact that people believe that supermarkets have a standard markup across the board. So if I'm standing in line to buy a block of cheese, it doesn't matter whether that block of cheese is New Zealand cheddar or whether it is Brie, because it would have the same markup. The reality of the situation is that the markup on a block of cheese is relatively small. And there are some supermarkets that would incur a loss on cheese because they believe that when I come into the supermarket, I will buy something else. It's called a loss leader. The challenge is that it seems that during COVID, they were selling lots of blocks of Anchor cheese. And the other cheese, which is the other one I mentioned, wasn't selling as well. And that is the one that carries a significantly higher markup and also a significantly higher cost. Supermarket has to stock both of them anyhow. I think the challenge is that the leadership of the unions that may have mentioned something like this, they're being lazy. And essentially, they are reflecting a popularly held opinion that once you see people lining up to go somewhere, it doesn't matter that that place is making a lot of money. When the reality is that it doesn't work that way. And coming out of it, I think it's the small shops, if it is shops, that really made a killing coming out of this whole COVID period. But I don't really know that that has continued. And certainly the supermarkets, I know that they were having a challenge, as you said. They were employing lots of people to stock baskets and so on to carry outside when supermarkets were closed. And then they were just selling the basic items. They weren't really making the high markups on things that they would normally have made the markup on. So I appreciate your analysis. I suspect a lot of people won't be happy to have heard you because people like this idea that supermarkets poking up people's eye and then sending them home. This is a very popular analysis for people to carry. So I suspect that a couple of people are going to be angry with you, but nonetheless, that is the nature of the business. It's good that you put the information out there. So I want to thank you for calling and for sharing that with the public. All right, this is Donna Brastocks. Good morning and welcome.
Good afternoon. Good morning and welcome. Good afternoon.
Morning there. How are you doing? It's good to hear a lady on the phone for a change.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm great. And yourself?
I'm good. What I want to call about, I was going to call ever since. First, I want to say that the late Prime Minister has passed because I couldn't get in at the time. I just want to give my sympathy. He's a people's person. And I just want to give my sympathy to him, Honorable Owen Arthur, to himself and family.
Okay.
I'm on the radio.
You are, yes, ma'am. Go right ahead. You're on the air. You have our full attention. Go ahead.
Okay. The other thing I want to say, the guy Carter that was over the COVID-19, calling the COVID-19 police, I think he did a fantastic job. But right now, you know, I want to say this here, right? It's a funny scenario. If you have a cut and you put on a plaster on it and it starts to heal, you don't continue to put on a plaster, right? How we look at it is COVID-19 right now in Barbados has done a fantastic job. Everybody's okay. But if you have a virus attacks the internal part of your system. It doesn't attack the outside. And people are wearing masks. I have a problem with people wearing masks and things like that. But I believe that for right now, because since Barbados have come to a stage where we have actually bring this thing a certain amount of control, and just the people that are coming in, I think what we can do is maybe stop people from wearing masks, cut off the masks, and allow people to deal with the communicable diseases. Like that young lady was coming through the communicable diseases. Allow people to build up their immune system. Use things that can help them. And kind of build up their immune system, start to target on the different foods and things that they eat, that they can build up their immune system. A lot of people were really sick before, and the older people is the one that this COVID-19 is going to affect. So I'm saying let people work on their health, the health area, so that at the end of the day, you can just, when you go into a shop, you can sanitize or you can put on, you can use the the other thing, like the temperature, you can do use the temperature, right? Mm-hmm. But you can take the mask off because those cloth masks are very dangerous sometimes. I mean, running for long hours. I can't keep on one of those for long, honestly. I had on one and I had to take it off. I recognize that I was short of breath because we're using those cloth masks all the time. You're breathing back in the same thing that you're breathing out all the time. So it's to me, it's more dangerous for you. But I'm saying let the people take the mask off. but you can still do the sanitizing and you can still do the temperature check. The people that are coming in, you're actually dealing with them because they're coming on the planes and things like that. You can deal with those, make sure they go through all the protocols and everything that they have to go through. But at the end of the day, those are the ones that are bringing it in. But it's not really community spread. So I'm saying open back the businesses and everything. Let the country roll. Let the country flow. Because right now, we're in financial chaos right now. We're in real financial chaos. And it's in our businesses and things open back up right now.
All right, ma'am, you said a couple of things that worry me. And let's deal with the whole mask issue first, right? The Panamerican Health Organization, World Health Organization, has indicated that mask wearing helps to stop the spread of COVID. For me, it's a no-brainer. If they're saying that mask wearing helps to reduce the likelihood that COVID will be spread, you wear a mask. I don't know that there's anything any further that needs to be discussed. They are the experts. You and I are not. And if they are saying to us that by wearing a simple mask, it will stop the spread of COVID, that's what we need to do. You're suggesting that it's either one versus the other. And I'm saying to you that, I don't know if you ever heard about the Heart and Stroke Foundation. They have an excellent program called the Tooth Creek Program, where they're looking at non-communicable diseases, specifically diabetes, in young people. And they're trying to ensure that we do things that will help to reduce our exposure to diabetes. So they're encouraging us to use less sugar, to stop drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, drink more water, exercise, all of these kinds of things. That is happening even now during COVID. And there's absolutely no reason why you can't do that. And you can also continue to wear your mask. Ma'am, I exercise. I am living in a country where it is legally required from the time I step out of my house to put on a mask. So once I leave the house, I have to wear a mask, okay? I have been to the gym, I have exercised in a mask. I have to admit, it's not fun. It's not something that I really want to do. But if I can do it and I can exercise in a mask, I believe that you can walk down the street in a mask. And, you know, people are raising a lot of artificial arguments to me to suggest that they can't do this and they can't do that. Ma'am, none of us like to do it, but it's pretty much, it is what it is. It is what you have to do. You are also hinted at the fact that one of the ways. Hold on, ma'am, let me finish and then you can respond.
Okay.
You're hinting at the fact that it would be wise if it is that we are importing COVID to stop importing COVID and let people have a little bit more freedom locally. So if it is that the COVID isn't here and we are importing it in flights, then the thing to do would be to stop the flights and essentially let people go and they can walk upon one another and crop over and all that kind of thing.
No,
that's not the problem.
I'm not saying that.
Well, I know. Maybe not you're saying that, but you're saying you could
do your sanitizing and you can still do your own thing.
But ma'am, hold on a second. Hold on, ma'am, let me finish now. I let you speak.
Go ahead.
Right. No, I'm saying that the challenge that we're going to have is that everyone has been saying to you that this country runs on tourism. The tourism sector is hurting because there are no tourists coming in. And the vast majority, probably 40% of the business activity that we have in Barbados is driven in some way, shape, or form by tourism. So it isn't as easy as saying you don't want the tourists to come in, because if the tourists don't come in, the country is going to grind to a halt and you will have other problems of an economic nature that are far more serious. So I think what government is doing is saying, let's see if we can manage our risk, right? And I think that is what they're doing. They're managing the risk. Continue with the mask wearing. Limited flights coming in. Everyone is being screened. To me, that is a way of ensuring that we can continue to live economically while we can manage the health risks and our exposure to that. Over to you now, ma'am.
Okay. All right. I have to go now, though. So thanks a lot, though.
All right. Well, I was hoping for a response. I'm sorry that you had to leave so abruptly because I wanted to hear your response before you said it. Anyhow, thanks a lot for calling, ma'am. 434-1790. Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Are you?
I'm good.
Right. I want to speak on the supermarket issue, but let me just say from the outset that I am not one way or another saying whether it is justifiable or not to send home people, because I don't know the ins and outs. I know I was talking with a friend of mine who owns a piece of place, and he telling me that he believes that it is genuine, that they're definitely not making as much as before, or they're not making money. And he's somebody that I have a lot of respect for and things. So I say that it may be so, but I don't have the evidence really. But what I know is that I can respond to some of the things that have been said. Now, people judge the performance of the hotels based upon the long lines. And I think that may not be a good metric to use because, as people said before, the lines were long because they were all on the outside and it was like a one line. In the supermarket, there would be several lines, so you would see they're looking short. Also, there was distancing, 6 feet apart, so you would see lines wrapping around the supermarket. So that does not translate into necessarily a lot of sales. But what you could look at to determine whether or not the supermarket was making a lot of money was the rate at which people were passing through the cashiers. And if the cashiers were always working. And I think it is fair to say that the cashiers were always working. There were no times when they had downtime. So the rate of passing through the cashiers was high for all of the period. And with respect now to... Oh, so I lost my train of thought there just now, but the rate of passing through was high it was higher than usual. That's the point I want to make. So that there are times when you get into the supermarket, sometimes you go at Massey and nobody is at the cashier. For some period, some cashiers are idle some part of the day. But during that COVID period, there was no downtime for cashiers. And if you spoke to any of them, they would tell you how tired they were. Mm-hmm. It was one of the fewest times that they ever had of getting any real break in between. Not the compulsory break, but the voluntary break when there were no people traveling through. So that's one point. Let me see what's the next point. Right. In addition to serving people at the cashiers, which is normal way, they increase the output by also doing deliveries. Because where one or two people were doing deliveries before, more people were now doing deliveries with the vehicles as well as sales at the cashier. So you had additional revenue, I would say. And on top of that, there were some cases where they even had like some dispatching outside, some at the cashier, and doing deliveries as well. So these amount to different ways in which, to me, the revenue stream was flowing a little faster than usual. Now, with respect to what the guy said about the selling basic items, well, I don't know. For me, COVID never made me bought any bottom end items. I continue to buy as usual, plus more. So when you say restock the low end items, I don't know about it because there was nothing in the supermarket that I wanted that I accustomed getting that I couldn't get except for things like sanitizers and vitamin C tablets and things like that. Those are the things that you couldn't get. And he didn't stock them. Not because he was trying to provide low end items for anybody. They were just simply unavailable for them to get them. So to tell me that their supermarket was flooded with all, they stopped buying bacon and they stopped buying things that cost money, that's a joke. The supermarket never was empty of those things. And I think the final point I had here was that, in terms of, you said, the higher security, supermarkets always have security. That's one thing. So I don't know that they had any more extra security. Supermarkets always have security. But what I can tell you, they added, though, was the sanitizers. But telling me that people had to sanitize people, that's a joke. Because a lot of the supermarkets have automatic sanitizers. You just put your hand underneath and they sanitize you automatically. Or if it is manual, they had the ones with the foot press. If you didn't install that is your business because you had to look at various means of cutting your costs. So you should have implemented those things, right? So that is my say my assessment. And Peter, you could tell me now what your view is on that.
No, I think that your analysis of the situation, even though it's well thought, though I think it's somewhat misguided. Someone is just telling me on the chat to start with that the pass rate of the cashier invariably means that every person has little. So when you have cashiers processing frequently a lot of people, it usually means that those people don't really have a lot. So the idea of them not having a break is not a relevant indicator. The next thing that you did, which I think is dangerous, is that you use yourself as an example. So I should not, you should not use yourself as an example. And I certainly can't use myself as an example. I didn't run out of anything during COVID. I didn't eat any differently during COVID. I started to cook for myself, which was something that was a little odd, but I perhaps ate more, but ultimately it wasn't like I was eating differently. But I don't think that I am a clear or usual indicator of what happened, because unlike many other people, I haven't lost my job. There are a number of people who not only during but after COVID were in situations financially where they had no money. And I spoke to an individual during the lockdown who told me that he was sent home and essentially had nothing in the house to eat. So for him, it was a question of what can you get in terms of the basic items that you can fulfill. So everyone knows that there was that going on. There were those cases. There were cases where people were able to get by during the COVID and now are finding themselves without work. You know, the number of taxi men that are at home that would normally have been going to the grocery, especially as the winter tourist season is on now, and shopping for their families and buying all of the stuff that they would enjoy, that are now in a situation where they're looking at back to school and trying to determine what is essential and what is not essential. So, sir, I can't understand how it is not possible for you to see that this would have impacted in terms of people's buying choices. And as I said, if you use the analysis of cheese, right, you can go to the supercenter in Whole Town. That's probably the best one to do the analysis of. And you can pick up a block of cheese that costs $50. You can also pick up a block of cheese that costs $3. The cashier processes both of them at the same speed. It's both cheese. But ultimately, the markup on the $50 cheese is significantly higher than the markup on the $3 cheese. And the amount of money that the supermarket would make from the $50 cheese is far higher. And I'm telling you that there are not a lot of people in Barbados that would eat the $50 cheese. But there are a lot of people in Barbados who would eat the $3 cheese, especially in a situation where you feel that you're going to have to be subjected to cheese cutters and ham cutters and bread and whatever that people would eat. So I can't understand how you're not seeing it, and I think that is unfortunate. We know one of the rules I've always used with social analysis is that I try not to use myself as an example of what people do, because I don't believe, sir, that I am typical of the average Barbadian in many ways, especially the average Barbadian that has lost his job during this COVID period. Over to you, sir.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that I said that when I went to the supermarket, I observed. And not, it's not just using me as an example of my purchases. Yes, I mentioned I purchase. I'm sure I'm not the only one that made, but I talk about observing in the supermarket. I said there's nothing that I accustomed wanted that I couldn't find. Not that I necessarily always purchase the same things, but things were on the supermarket shelves look the same way to me all the time. With respect to people buying big blocks of cheese and small blocks of cheese, they were always poor people. And even though there were some were not working now that were working before, there were always people at the lower end, and people have always been thrifty as far as I am concerned, because even from the days we were talking about VAT, people were always thrifty. Those who buy the lower end products were always buying them. So the supermarket always had people passing through the supermarket who never had a lot of money. So COVID might just make it a little bit worse, but the point is, everybody still had to eat. Groceries had to buy. Don't think that because somebody was unemployed to stop eating. Even if they didn't purchase the goods themselves, somebody purchased them for them. So the supermarket was still flowing. With respect to passing through the cashier, the number of people passing through, if I pass through a cashier and I take 10 minutes and two people take 5 minutes, it doesn't matter. The point is how fast the goods are passing across the scanner. And it doesn't matter how many people there are that pass through. If one person went to a teller today and stood from morning to evening passing through the goods, it is equivalent to if 100 people pass through. So the number of people doesn't even matter. It is how many goods pass across the scanner and goes into the cash register. And what we know for sure is that that was happening all day long. Goods were passing through the scanner. And even if you agree, if I agree with you that some of the goods there would be less in price, the point is the frequency was higher. There was never, ever any downtime during COVID time. So you could reasonably conclude the money was at the same level, or I guess it could be higher. That's my point of view.
All right. So I'm going to end the conversation by reading to you a note which was sent from one of the WhatsAppers, and it says, Peter, I agree with yourself and previous caller, and I'm speaking from experience. During the first month or so in curfew, certainly the supermarkets would have made a killing, but from around the ending of April until now, the small businesses and wayside vendors and mini marts, those who sell fruit and vegetable deposits, increased, in my opinion, by 200%. I'm a member of the union, but I do not agree with their assessment, since I can see for myself. I went into Cape Shepherd yesterday, and it was like a ghost town. I have never seen anything like that before. And I should also make the point very quickly that a number of these people who are selling fruit and vegetables now are people who were otherwise employed previously in the other areas and are now unemployed, and as a result have turned to what I would say are small-scale retail operations where they're selling selling apples and oranges and think that they buy from somebody wholesale that they're selling at the side of the road. And that is what you could say is business to get by. But ultimately, it doesn't really mean that there is any increase in the business generation to any extent. Anyhow, sir.
Just make this last point, and that is that we were not discussing stores in town because we know that the stores, a lot of businesses closing. We know that. We
were talking about
supermarkets. We were talking about supermarkets. So we get the top of Bridgetown, though.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about what stuff, you know, when they're talking about. We are talking about Care Shepherd and all about it. We're talking about supermarkets.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. We're talking about supermarkets. All right, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. It was good chatting with you. I'm conscious of the fact that very shortly Dennis is going to take me over to the regional roundup. So I want to try and see if we can get another call or two in. Remember, we break at 12 for the regional roundup, and then we break at 12:30 for the latest. Sorry, we break at 11:55 for the regional roundup. Donna Brastax, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Vickham.
Morning, ma'am. How are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you as well?
I'm good. I'm blessed, even.
Thank you very much. I just want me a suggestion here, Santa. About a couple of weeks ago, I had called on the nation to come out and to get some sort of organization to help with the Silver Dollar Drive in order like to help the Ministry of Education with the school. So that when school come back up, that they will get the tablets. And some people that ain't got internet at home, so that the Silver Dollar Drive would have happened. But I never hear none of the callers calling to me and say if the decision that I had said was right. And this is something that is on my heart, because I feel like the nation could come about and, you know, we could get a burger can and put it in a good location in the city. And everybody that passing could drop in a silver dollar and let me fill it that can full and present it to the Ministry of Education. But some organization will have to come out and do it. I would like to know who could do it and when they could do it, because that is something that I feel that could be done, so that they will help a lot of the children that ain't get tablets, you know, yet, and be able to help get like the internet in the homes. Yes, I know a lot of other people contribute, but we as a nation could do that. I feel like a lot of the Calypsonians, the gospel artists, we could contribute to that. They may do something, you know, so that we could contribute to that. Right, Mr. Vickham? I feel that something
okay, ma'am. Fair enough.
Could happen. You understand? Mm-hmm. But I want to hear some of the callers calling to see if it's something that is a good suggestion. Or let's talk about that, because that's something that I feel that should happen, because I feel it will go a long way. You know, it's filling up a burger paint can full to the top with $7, Mr. Ellis, and presenting it to the Ministry of Education. That would do something great. You understand what I mean? That's better than moving. That's better right now than taking down Nelson. You understand? You know that's better.
I think
that will help.
I can't agree with you. I think the two things are mutually exclusive. I think that a country can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think that we can raise funds to buy tablets for children, and we can also remove Nelson at the same time. There's nothing wrong with the proposal that you're making. You're saying that there needs to be a fundraising drive to buy tablets for children going back into school. I'm interested in knowing some stats and some details regarding the number of children who are currently pursuing an education that do not have access to tablets. In many of the Caribbean countries, government essentially gives children who are receiving school books tablets as an option. And they're so cheap right now, one wonders why, if we have a school book lending program, we can't just have a tablet program that replaces that. So I don't think that it is something that is beyond our capacity as a nation. And certainly we ought to think about it. Well, the music tells me that it is time to go for the regional roundup, not at 55, but at 45. So 55, 54. All right. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks. Remember, we're with you now until 12:30. And then after that, we'll live with you until 2 p.m. So we do hope you stay with us. Remember, you can call us on 434-1790. You can use the chat, 266-IVOB. Or alternatively, you can email me directly at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. Lady tells me that a gentleman tells me that the lady who spoke about the silver dollar drive needs to know that a lot of unemployed people out there also need a $2 drive, not only the ministry. The ministry is receiving numerous donations of devices, and the majority of the devices went in different directions. It's all 100% positive. And then another WhatsApper tells me or reminds me of the recent donation by the Lodge School alumni that has been donating 56 laptops with protective cases to assist students with online learning. And the suggestion is that alums can get together to help raise funds to ensure that the government, that the students at the various schools have all the necessary devices that they need. So I was saying to the lady, though, I do feel that there is a basis on which we should have some kind of an audit of the needs to understand in every school what is the level of penetration regarding tablets, whether there are people who actually need tablets, whether there may be some kids that have access to two or three of them, and to get a sense of where we are in this regard, because I get the impression that the absence of a tablet in the home is a rarity. And I would be curious to know how many situations arise in which there's a genuine absence of any tablet and there's no access to one either from the ministry or from any other source. But still, we continue 434-1790 and say good afternoon and welcome to the next caller.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome. Hi, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Hi, good afternoon. Am I on?
You are on, yes, ma'am. Welcome. First person after lunch.
Hi, good afternoon, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. I just want to touch on our judicial system in Barbados as it relates to dispensing of justice. I'm very concerned. I'm looking at an article. I read an article in today's paper as it relates to a case where a gentleman lost his life through a vehicular accident. And to me, it seems as though the driver of himself pleaded guilty to two charges as it related to that death. However, he was finally only charged or convicted on one and was able to walk away with a slap on the wrist. He was either ordered to pay $400 or 40 days in prison. Now, reading the article, obviously the police tried to bring in place the additional charge, which apparently the lawyer for the driver, obviously is arguing, and this matter has been thrown out. My concern is this is setting a precedent, because even reading the article, and the police have indicated that there are similar cases where persons are being charged similarly for vehicular accidents. So it seems to me this is going to be
a situation where drivers would be easily getting away with a slap on your wrist. And it really begs, you know, the question as what is really happening here with our system? 2 weeks, about 3 days ago, I also read an article where three persons were remanded to prison. But among the three persons was one person who was out on three murders and then found himself involved in another criminal offense.
You got to be careful there, though, because the person that committed three murders, the person was charged with three murders.
That they were charged. Yes, let me withdraw that. Yeah. Right? But my point is, if you're charged, then why are you on our streets? It took him now to commit another offense in order for him to be remanded. So my question, you know, as a citizen out here, when I read these things, I have to ask myself, what is happening to our judicial system when it comes to dispensing justice?
Right. Okay. Let me start with the second one, because this is something that I'm very familiar with. You are alleged to have killed someone, and you're charged with murder. You go up to Glendaria on remand, and you're on remand for a year. The point at which police have not been able to bring charges against you for 1 year, one would assume that you have a right to due process. You are innocent until proven guilty. And ultimately, the fact that you are charged and you're up there means that you are being detained unfairly. So you go to court and the court gives you bail because they have not been able to start the case against you. One would assume, ma'am, that if the case against you was so strong and so easy to prove, the state would have started that case. And the fact that the state has not started that case makes me wonder whether it is really that strong. And as a result, you get out and you're charged with another murder. A year passes and you're back out in relation to that matter. If you are the kind of person that seems to get involved in activity where you're likely to be charged with murder and you do it habitually, one would assume that the interest of the state should be in ensuring that one of these cases goes to trial and that you're convicted and essentially locked away to ensure that you can't do this kind of thing again. The problem that we have been having is that until such time as the Bail Act was changed recently, which of course impacted on the Constitution of Barbados, a person after 1 year was pretty much entitled to bail on murder because it took them too long. You recall some time ago that a policeman shot someone in the back on a Sunday afternoon with his service revolver. And he has been charged with murder after he went back to work the next day. He's now charged with murder and he was essentially waiting trial for over a year. He's also on bail. The challenge, ma'am, is that our system has an obligation to ensure that people get speedily before the courts, the cases are heard quickly. But what we have been hearing for a long time is that the court doesn't seem to have the capacity to deal with these matters expeditiously because the court is so overwhelmed doing goodness knows what, you know? You have a situation where, and this is something that I get very irritated about, every time you have a call there at court, you see 50 and 60 minibuses. You see people going charged for breaking the speed limit, people being charged for parking illegally at the airport, people being charged for rolling stop, all that nonsense. And those people are clogging up the court system when the court system should be dealing with serious offenses. So I agree with you, ma'am, that we have some work to do in that regard. I think that the process has already been started. The government has changed the Bail Act, and as a result, persons now don't get bail until they're in prison for 2 years. And one would hope that within that two-year period of time, government has ensured that we now have an adequate number of judges that can deal with these matters that are backlogged and that they should be able to clean the matter up and deal with it so that when a person is charged, the person can get before the court quickly, you know? And that's my concern. You made another point about the judiciary. What was it you were saying, ma'am? I remember the second one, but not the first.
Right. So I am concerned about this second one in particularly where this is a vehicular accident. The person lost the driver pleaded guilty to both charges. And you have a case where one of the charges is driven by the DPP.
No, the guy pleaded guilty. The guy was charged and pleaded guilty to driving with dangerous driving. And I think that's what he was charged for. He got charged $500 for dangerous driving. The problem here, ma'am, is a technical one in which the state has to bring these cases properly. If you charge me for an offense and I plead guilty to an offense, even though I may know very well that that's a lesser offense, it's what you have charged me with. It's nobody's fault other than the person who is bringing the charges. So I don't know whether it is the police prosecutor, whether it's the director of public prosecutions, but someone has to clean up the act. But in the final analysis, you can't have a situation where you bring me to court, charge me with one thing, I am convicted or I plead guilty to that, and then you bring me back as I'm leaving and you charge me for another thing in relation to the same offense. It's not tidy and it's also not legal, right? What's to stop me from saying, okay, you're going to charge me for one, and if that don't succeed, you're going to then charge me for another, maybe where would it end? There has to be legal certainty. So I think what needs to happen is that we need to have some guidelines from the Director of Public Prosecutions regarding what is to happen in those situations. I think the police have to be very clear in terms of how they charge people. You know, I mean, there was a situation some time ago in Jamaica where a guy was charged with murder and he killed a person. But because he was charged with murder and all of the ingredients of murder weren't there, the guy walked free when he should perhaps have been charged with a lesser offense, which is manslaughter. And I'm just saying that these are the kinds of guidance that needs to come from the I don't know if it's a DPP or who, maybe the Chief Justice, I'm not sure who. But ultimately, Peter, it has to come from somewhere.
But this is why I'm confused, Peter, because if I can interject, reading the article, the gentleman was charged with two offenses to which he pleaded guilty. Somehow, the magistrate only allowed one of them, because the DPP is who made the suggestion that he should not be charged for the other one.
No, I heard, I read it differently to you. I read that he was charged with one offense by the magistrate. He pleaded guilty to that offense, and that was that. And now he's being called back and charged with a second offense. Dennis obviously read the same article as
I did. You and I are not reading the same article, because if you read the article did say he was charged for two. He pleaded guilty for the two. For some reason, one was thrown out.
Yeah, I didn't read that.
One, and then the police obviously tried to have that other charge reinstated, and this is where the whole issue is. But I still say what I'm saying. Our judicial system seems to be failing us. It seriously seems to be failing us, because it seems as though the victims don't have any rights at all in this country. Anyway, Peter, you have a good day.
No, I'm reading the thing, ma'am, and I think that you are. I mean, you said when he appeared in the traffic court before Gravely Bannister, he pleaded guilty to both charges. The charge of driving without reasonable consideration was withdrawn. A magistrate defined till $400 forthwith or 40 days in prison. The traffic court license was suspended and set up for 9 months. The police charged till this time with causing death. The impression I'm getting here was that death was not not part of the first charge. So you're saying two, but there is a charge of driving without reasonable consideration withdrawn. And he was charged for driving with reckless driving or whatever. But the point is that the death charge of death by causing death was not instituted until the 9th of March this year. The question is whether you can charge a person again. But the tool that you're talking about, death was not part of it. You still there, ma'am? You're not. You're gone. Okay. All right. I guess we'll hear some more about it. But clearly, there needs to be some guidance. I think the Director of Public Prosecutions probably needs to give guidance to the police sources regarding the way in which these matters are to be pursued. But I understand the concern that the caller is raising, but I also feel that there has to be some clarity in the way that the law is applied, so you don't have people coming into court and being charged several times in relation to the same matter as the state decides to wake up one morning and decide, okay, we're going to charge you for this. Donna Brastacks, good morning. Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome. You're on the air. All right. 434-1790 is the number you can call. Remember, we break in about 10 minutes for the latest news. Good afternoon and welcome. All right. I believe the caller is there. I'm seeing Dennis is raising his hand, but the person isn't speaking to me. Good afternoon and welcome.
City man, I called for a gentleman, man.
Peter, you called for the gentleman? Yes,
I'm
ma'am.
I'm calling here on the behalf of a poor man, mister. Good afternoon.
I'm sorry.
You're hearing me now?
I am hearing you now. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let me say this now. I'm calling on behalf of a pensioner. He is sick. He's 75 years old. For this some reason or another, this morning he got up from his bed. Not that I did not call the water rates and all of us. And somebody knocked the meter off of the man's house. And the water is running. He lives in the Bayland, Beckers Road, Clark Avenue at the corner. the water is running outside. He cannot get no water inside the house. Nobody to bring no water for him. I cannot carry a skillet for him because I am unable myself. So I am asking the water certificate, ask the water works. I did my best for the morning. To please go and put back on the meter, let the poor man get a little water in the house. There ain't nobody to bring the water for us. They don't know how we old people suffer. Please do something for the man. I called him twice already for the morning. And another person called too. So that's all.
When you called, what was the response that you were getting, ma'am?
I'm getting nothing. She said she's very nice and pleasant. She told me she would put it through to somebody and the next, and nobody come as yet.
Okay.
So just want the meter want put him back to the host, right? So he can't.
Okay, ma'am.
Well,
let's hope that the call that you've made to us will add some fuel, light a fire underneath the person that took the report. Hopefully, they will get the old guy started out before the end of the day so he can get a bath and get some water to get some tea to drink. Okay, ma'am, thank you for calling, and let's hope that this works. So, Donny Brastax, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. I just heard your conversation with the previous caller speaking about the court cases. I've heard this statement mentioned a number of times on the radio. I've heard it with David Ellis, and I thought I heard it with you. I may have been mistaken when you said a person is innocent until they're proven guilty. I'm confused at that because I thought that they're presumed innocent until they're proven guilty. Because if a person enters court already innocent, then there's no need for trial, right?
Mm-hmm. What's the difference, though?
Pardon?
What's the difference?
Well, one is that innocence is that you're already found innocent. So if you start from that you are already innocent, then there's no need for trial. But if you start from
what I'm trying to understand is what is the functional difference with regard to what we were speaking about, which is the main issue here?
No. I'm not talking regarding kids. I just keep hearing this statement being regurgitated, and I think that one may lead to collective consciousness that a person, especially even people who are looking at committing crimes, that they're innocent, but they're not. They are the accused, first of all, and that they have.
Right. Fair enough. All right, no problem. The presumption of innocence, right? So they're presumed innocent. Okay, that's it, sir.
That's it.
Thank you for calling. Yeah, Dr. Brastax, good afternoon. Yes, good afternoon and welcome. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm good, sir. Yourself?
I'm pretty all right. And just for clarity, charges are upgrading in Barbados all the time, so it's perfectly legal to do that. In most cases of where someone dies unnaturally and the investigations reveal that the person was murdered and there's a suspect in custody, and there's an autopsy done that shows that the person killed the person or died as a result of the injuries inflicted by the other person, the initial charge is usually grievous bodily harm, which we call a holding charge. And until the autopsy is done and that evidence is available, then it's upgraded to murder or manslaughter or whatever. Right? That's one example. Now, as far as the driving without due care and attention, and without reasonable consideration for others, you can plead guilty to both, but the magistrate will only find you on one, or convict you on one, and then impose a fine or whatever on that. Because they're almost like, I won't say duplication, but there's a thin line between the both of them. So once you plead guilty to one, the fine or the sentence or whatever is equal. So if you plead guilty to the other,
Sir, help us here, because the issue that she's speaking about, help us understand what went wrong in relation to that issue. I think that's a more useful conversation that we need to have.
I didn't read the article. Actually, I'm driving.
Yeah, but sir, but you calling about the article?
No, I'm calling about what you brought on the table, which is driving without due care and attention, and the other one, without reasonable consideration, and why can be upgraded. So the initial charge would be, if it was a road traffic accident, the initial charge would be probably causing dangerous driving or whatever. But when an autopsy is done, the investigation by the police would have to have the evidence to support a charge of something more serious, like causing death with dangerous driving. And that is where the other charge is instituted. So when you speak about it being unfair to bring an additional charge, that is not true. That's how it works.
No, but you can't say that what I'm saying is not true, because I'm saying that this is what was argued in relation to this gentleman by the lawyer, and the magistrate seems to believe that there is some substance to it, because he has sent to the DPP for an opinion.
Wait.
So is it me that's saying it? I'm reading from a newspaper article that you haven't read, and I'm saying to you that what the newspaper article states is that the gentleman was charged with two offenses. That was not one of them. There was a move to charge him for a further offense. I didn't see the word upgrade anywhere in the article. But what has happened is that the gentleman's lawyer has now objected and saying that there's no basis on which that can be done. And Balustrade Bannister has apparently adjourned the matter and referred it to the DPP for an opinion.
Yes.
So isn't that I am deceiving anybody? I'm reading newspaper.
No, I'm saying that is the correct procedure. But you were saying before that it's unfair to bring an additional charge a person.
So that's what the lawyer has said. She cited several cases and argued that charging Tull after he was convicted and sentenced on those death accounts, especially after the magistrate took into account the death of Sergeant, reeks of unfairness and oppressiveness to Tull, and it is a clear abuse of process. That's exactly what the article says, sir.
Well,
so this is not me speaking. This is an attorney at law that's arguing on the gentleman's behalf. I'm sure it was a convincing argument because it seemed to have persuaded the magistrate.
It's kind of sub judice. I am an attorney at law also, and that's why I give you that position.
But sir, if you were, and that's fine, if you're an attorney at law, that's fine. So then what you need to do is to read the article. You need to speak to the case that is before the court. You need to speak to the evidence that is in the newspaper. Because I don't know whether sub judice, the part of the matter is reported in the newspaper, so it is available for conversation. So I'm saying that when you're speaking to me, it makes more sense to speak with respect to the facts that are on the table and give me some guidance from your impressive legal background to help me understand what's going on here.
But Peter, I'm saying to you that even the newspaper don't have all the facts. The facts are in the courtroom.
But the facts in the newspaper, sir, is you that don't have the facts.
I am saying that they don't have all the facts. That's what I'm saying.
But sir, you don't have all the facts because you don't know the case that's in the paper, but you're here telling me that people who are speaking don't have the facts.
You can listen to what I'm saying. I didn't say that. I said that the newspaper don't have all the facts, and that's why the matter has been referred to the DPP for guidance. That's what I'm saying to you. I don't have all the facts either because it was not in the courtroom. Neither are you or anybody else that was there. I mean, that are making comments on the matter. So I'm saying that each case turns on its own peculiar facts. So until we have all of the facts, then the people who made the decision. That's my point. Is that?
Sir, I would like you to do me a favor. When you go, can I realize you're driving now, and I hope that you're driving with due care and attention. But I realize that you're driving. I would like you to read the article in the newspaper, and I believe Dennis is on tomorrow. Give Dennis a call and speak to Dennis with regard to your opinion on what ought to be done. Because it's pretty clear that the article's utility is in suggesting that the common practice that is being used within the police force or prosecution office or whatever regarding the charging of individuals is flawed. And that there are two other matters which will have to be dealt with. So certainly it would make sense to do that. Read it and let Dennis get the benefit of your legal opinion on the matter. I am no lawyer. I really don't know. But as I said, I just read the newspaper. All right, sir? I want to thank you for your contribution. We have to take a break now because it's time to go for the latest news. We should be back with you in about 10 minutes. To stay with us.